Well, congratulations to the class of 2010. I am delighted to be here on this beautiful and historic campus. That was the original line. I should add now, I'm delighted to be here in this beautiful and historic field house. I had the honor yesterday of coming to dinner and was able to see the original layout and the original chairs out there. So I would like to join President Taylor in one more round of applause for your amazing staff here at Knox, because they have really done you proud this morning. I'm also delighted to be back here in the Midwest. Now, you couldn't tell by looking at me, but I am a born and bred Midwesterner, and I am really happy to be back home. A little applause for the Midwest, that's right. And thank you, Professor Civitini, for that generous introduction and nomination. I had the pleasure of hearing about Professor Civitini's work on psychology and politics yesterday. And it's a topic I feel like I'm living every day. So it was very momentous and interesting to me just to hear the study of my life. And thank you, President Taylor. It is a special treat to be welcomed by you. I think it's fair to say that President Taylor, in his prior career, when he was merely Roger Taylor Esquire, was the first lawyer I worked for when I started my legal career. This was during the summer after my first year in law school, when the lucky few were able to get a head start on their peers, who must wait until the second summer to be a summer associate at a big law firm. Even then, Mr. Taylor Esquire was as much teacher as he was lawyer, treating me with patience, humor, and good advice. He was already foreshadowing the qualities that have made his second career here at Knox such a resounding success. Leadership, vision, and above all, a deep concern and care for the young people placed in his charge. Knox, I can attest to you from personal experience that you have indeed been fortunate to have had Roger Taylor as your president. And thank you, Knox College, for the great honor of awarding me this degree and placing me in the company of my fellow honorary degree recipients, Kwame Dawes and Jim Owens. You have made my late father, a physician, very happy today. He always preferred that I become a doctor rather than a lawyer. And thank you and congratulations to the parents of the class of 2010, including my good friend David Orr, father of Michael Orr, who I just saw on the way in. The sense of achievement, relief, pride, and wonder that you must be feeling today. Looking at these young people, now fully adults, remembering back to the toddlers learning to walk, the first graders learning to read, the preteens adjusting to their hormones. I actually happen to have one of those at home right now. And the teenagers with hormones full in force, just being. You must be thinking, how is it that they are about to be college graduates? Which leads inevitably to the thought, how is it that I got so old to have a child who's a college graduate? I know I'm one of you. I'm watching you and practicing for next week when I sit in your seat and watch my own member of the class of 2010, my son Patrick, walk across the stage at UCLA. And to the class of 2010, let me start by putting right out there on the table what you must be thinking right now. You're thinking, class of 2005, Barack Obama. Class of 2006, Stephen Colbert. Class of 2007, President Bill Clinton. Class of 2008, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Class of 2009, U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald. And for us, the mighty class of 2010, we get Tina Chen. In a nod of sympathy to my fellow honorary degree awardee, Dr. Dawes, isn't she the one who couldn't get to the pump handle this year through the fog? And so now we speak at commencement? What is this, flunk day? All right, I confess I have the same feeling of bewilderment, because as those of you who are regular readers of the Galesburg Register Mail know, this is my first commencement address. So not only do you get the not so famous, you get a rookie. So, but my apologies, and but also my profound thanks to the class of 2010 for choosing me as your speaker. I will try not to let you down. Now, Knox has a fine tradition of rookies, because I know my current boss, President Barack Obama, to this day remembers and speaks fondly of his appearance here at Knox as his first commencement address when he was just a newly elected and not particularly well-known junior senator from Illinois. Now, I hold no illusions that this occasion marks the start of such a trajectory for me. But I am no less honored and grateful for the invitation and the opportunity to share this all-important day for Knox College. So what, you may now be asking, did she do to deserve the invite? It was likely not because of my first career, which was that of corporate lawyer, partner in a big international law firm, and a litigator, no less. It is likely my second career, which I suspect is the source of my invitation to be here today. But for that career, I'm not sure I can take a lot of personal credit. I come to you today as the director of the White House Office of Public Engagement, the executive director of the White House Council on Women and Girls, and a deputy assistant to the President of the United States, mostly because I, like the Knox College class of 2005, had the serendipitous opportunity many years ago to run into a tall guy with big ears and a funny sounding name, as he likes to describe himself, long before others knew who he was. But regardless of the reason, the opportunity to serve in these positions is the chance of a lifetime. It has given me a sense of pride and wonderment at the great country we live in, to witness the dedication of the men and women who work in our military, our public government agencies, and in the office of the president. To simply go to the office every day through the iron gates of the White House and through the doors of the West Wing is a breathtaking experience every time I do it. And I'm especially fortunate to be doing the work that is now my responsibility there. First, as the director of the Office of Public Engagement, as Professor Sabatini noted, I run the outreach office at the White House, meaning we are the place where ordinary Americans and constituency groups and concerned activists interact with the president. And this president has emphasized the importance of public engagement, hence the name of our office, and the value of hearing a broad range of views as he makes his decision. In addition, my office is working hard to make the White House truly the people's house by making the rich diversity of our country heard and represented within the iron gates of the White House. This includes, for example, holding the first observance of the Hindu holiday of Diwali in the East Room of the White House, where the president lit the Diva lamp, and bringing a small group of civil rights icons like the late Dr. Dorothy Height, together with children too young to remember those struggles, into the Oval Office to see where our nation's first African-American president has hung an original copy of the Emancipation Proclamation. And just last week, we hosted the first Jewish American Heritage Month celebration, with Sandy Koufax joining young Jewish leaders and Supreme Court justices as our guests. It includes Taishioma Bathia, an eighth grader from Dillon, South Carolina, whose school was literally falling down around her and her fellow students. She wrote a letter asking for help for her school, which led us to invite Taishioma and her mother to sit with the First Lady during the President's first joint session speech to Congress. This was her first plane ride, and in the aftermath, her school was flooded with donations, new furniture, and a facelift. It includes the guests who watched the President sign last year's Public Lands Management Act. Now, that's a law that you might not think has a human interest element, but we found out that Frank Chi Valletta, who served as a Navajo code talker for the US Army in World War II, lives in a community in the Navajo Nation that through this law will receive clean running water for the first time. That's right, clean running water for the first time in the year 2009. It was our privilege to have Mr. Valletta in his Code Talker uniform join us at the White House in the front row with the president as the bill was signed. And one of my most moving moments for me personally was the first time I stood in the White House with my hand over my heart to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, something I, like all of us, have done many times. But this time, it was at the ceremony where we had active duty members of our military who hailed originally from countries around the globe and had immigrated to the United States, sworn in as U.S. citizens. To say the pledge together with these new citizens who are performing the most patriotic of duties was a true honor and privilege. Now, I'm also the executive director of the White House Council on Women and Girls. And as Professor Sabatini noted, this is a different kind of council. Our members are every federal agency and every policy office in the White House. It is organized that way because, as the president said when he created the council last year, we want every part of the federal government to understand that it is their responsibility to take into account the interests of women and girls in what they do every day. Because whether they are the Department of Agriculture or the Department of Veterans Affairs or something in between, the work of their agency touches the lives of the women who work there and the lives of women and girls across America and beyond. This is important because wage discrimination still exists. Women still make only 78 cents for every dollar a man makes, because the rate at which women die from childbirth and pregnancy in this country is higher than that of 40 other industrialized countries. Because every year in the United States, 1.5 million women are raped or physically assaulted by an intimate partner. And because in the developing world, 1 out of every 7 girls is married before her 15th birthday. And even as women make progress at places like Knox, where I know not only are women 60% of the undergraduates, but 100% of your class officers are women. Women still hold only 17% of the seats in Congress. They comprise less than 3% of Fortune 500 CEOs. And today, they are only 1/4 of the US Supreme Court, although we hope to improve that percentage by bringing it up to 1/3 if the president's nomination of Elena Kagan to the court is confirmed by the US Senate. Now, these are just some of the reasons that I go to work every day, inspired to do more, conscious of the time going by, and acutely aware of one of the big lessons of the last year, that no matter how much we want it, or how many people voted for it in the last election, change is hard. It's hard on a personal level. You know this, or you're about to find it out, as you go through a major life-changing moment, the moment you leave Knox and move on to the adult phase of your life. I just went through a life-changing moment myself, proving that you are never too old for change. As I moved from Chicago last year, my home of 30 years, leaving my job of 23 years, my community that I loved, and devoted many hours to improving its schools and libraries and its Chinatown, even to come to one of the most exclusive work addresses on the planet, I have found days when I'm still disoriented, still learning to find my new personal equilibrium. I suspect you will find yourselves in similar places in the weeks and months to come. Change takes you out of your comfort zone, but that's the essence of change. If you aren't challenged, if you aren't nervous, if you aren't even scared, then you're not changing enough. And if you aren't changing, you aren't growing. It's as W.E.B. Du Bois said, you must be ready at any moment to give up what you are for what you might become. Or as Ben Franklin said a little more succinctly, when you're finished changing, you're finished. Change is hard on a broader level too. Just look at our first 16 months in Washington. Yes, we passed health care reform after contentious debate and great effort across the administration. and we continue to move forward on the other major issues on our agenda. But changing an entire country is hard. The entire country is being challenged out of its comfort zone and into a vision of the future, of what America and the world should be in the 21st century. The change we are undergoing is nothing less than building the foundation, not just for your future, but for the future of your children and your grandchildren. But change takes time. For me, I am remembering one of my mother's most constant lessons, the one about patience. In many ways, and you parents know this, it is every parent's lesson. From patience on car trips. No, we're not there yet. At Christmas, Hanukkah, or birthdays. No, you can't open the presents yet. To staying out past 10 p.m. No, never, but not yet. But patience is key. Good things, important things, like building friendships, doing public service to improve a community you love, creating a home, take time. I heard 30 years to build that in Chicago and 16 months in the bubble that is Washington is not enough time, and patience is required. Changing a country takes even more time, especially in America. As President Obama said in his commencement address in Michigan last month, democracy in a nation of more than 300 million people is inherently difficult. It has always been noisy and messy, contentious and complicated. Given my day job, I know firsthand that everyone has a voice and we want an involved, active electorate. That means to the disappointment of those who voted for the president, and I suspect the relief of those who didn't, there are few things that can be changed with the stroke of a single pen. Most of the hard things to change, climate and energy policy, comprehensive immigration reform, repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, require Congress to act, and these things take time. But as hard as change is, as long as it may take, the final message is, change is important. It's worth it. It's worth it for 10-year-old Marcellus Owens. Marcellus is the young boy who was standing at President Obama's elbow when he signed the Affordable Care Act into law. In a new shirt and tie, I might add that my resourceful staff were able to get to for Marcellus just moments before the ceremony began. Marcellus's 27-year-old mother died from hypertension, a treatable condition, but she had no health insurance, and she wasn't able to get the care that could have saved her life. It is worth it to change how we manage our precious planet. It is worth it to improve the lives, and indeed save the lives, of the world's women and girls. And so now, as you embark on your own personal change, you are in a position to be part of, to lead the change we need to build the America of the 21st century, the world of your future. And because it takes time, and because it is hard, we need you to be involved, to be, in the words of the name of my office, engaged. And especially, we need you to be involved because it's important. Whether you agree with our administration or whether you disagree, being engaged in the process of change is how you will make your voice heard, how you will share in shaping the change that is happening, how you will have the satisfaction, even with the occasional frustration and disappointment, of living your life as an involved, informed, active, responsible, and rewarded citizen. Because what I found out long before I got to Washington, D.C., was that some of my most cherished accomplishments, moments, and friendships came from the time I spent in volunteer public service. It was watching my children make friends with members of the homeless community in Uptown as they helped serve a hot meal at our church food pantry. It was eating homemade tamales at the joyous celebration when we cut the ribbon on a new public library on the west side of Chicago. It was watching amazing young inner city girls at Chicago's Young Women's Leadership Charter School recite their own powerful and empowering poetry. Your years here at Knox College have prepared you better than most to be leaders and activists in this change. To be leaders and activists who know the value of diversity, who appreciate the benefits of public service, and who have the talent and patience to see change through. Leaders like your fellow alum Jennifer Jones, known as JJ. JJ was a philosophy major here at Knox and graduated in the class of 1994. JJ's life has come full circle, in many ways thanks to Knox. She spent the first few years of her life in public housing in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and was only the second person in her family to attend college. The house she grew up in, and where her mother lives to this day, was made available through a federal government home ownership program for low-income families. She is now a presidential appointee at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, where she works on public and Indian housing. It was Knox that taught JJ, a young African-American lesbian from Tulsa, Oklahoma, about grassroots activism. She was one of only a handful of openly gay students on campus and the only out person of color during her 4 years at Knox. Yet in her sophomore year, she helped resurrect and revitalize the LGBT student group. In her own words, JJ says that her dedication and commitment to political activism were born out of the amazing experience she had here at Knox, an experience you all now share. So class of 2010, go forth into the world and be a part of the change, whether it's your own personal change, whether it's change in your local community, or whether it's change on a global scale. We are waiting for your leadership. We are looking forward to sharing in your achievements. Congratulations, 2010.